Okay, welcome to a new episode of Für ihn Ostwärts. This time with a special guest that I've wanted to have on for like a while now. Welcome, Ray Jung.
Thanks for having me.
You are a program associate at the Wilson Center, and you're also a Wuhan native who now lives in DC. So you, in many ways, are someone who has, I think, a unique perspective on a lot of the stuff that's been going on, because you don't only do the political analysis, but you also have like a personal insight into like the things that have been going on in Wuhan. And I was hoping that we might be able to talk about some of those, and also especially the combination of those two. I wanted to start by asking you, Wuhan is a city that I think everyone who's from China and who's like been to China kind of just knows exists, but a lot of people in the world had never heard of the city before, before January this year, probably. And I was wondering whether you could tell us what are things that you think people should know about the city or that make up the city for you, even though now it's no kind of just known for like a virus in the rest of the world.
Sure. So Wuhan for me, I would say it embodies a typical Midwestern Rust Belt industrial city image because of its history as a shipping hub within China, even dating back to Imperial China, where the ports by the Yangtze River acted as a sort of port for goods and people. Wuhan's definitely defined by its, connection to the river. A lot of our food specialties, carbs notwithstanding, are related to fish or lotus roots. And so it's very much a river, side city. And modern day Wuhan is actually three cities combined: Hanyang, Wuchang, and Hankou. So its size of about 11 million people is pretty large. I would also add, in relation to the current coronavirus crisis, that Wuhan has a pretty complex medical system because of the large amount of universities within the city limits. So when the coronavirus hit initially, what my initial reaction was, well, Wuhan has a pretty large, pretty developed healthcare system. So for it to be tested like this virus is probably a really big deal. And I have a aunt working in one of the hospitals, Zhongnan hospitals, and from my impressions of the healthcare system there was that it was pretty well equipped. The doctors there were pretty highly specialized and, consummate professionals. And so that knowledge of that healthcare system, I think, was something that really clued me in on how much damage this virus was going to do. Not to say that the healthcare system is perfect. China's healthcare system notoriously has really long wait times and a lot of out-of-pocket costs for patients, but relative to other healthcare systems, there wasn't anything subpar, I would say, about Wuhan's hospitals.
Yeah, I think that's like a really important point, especially also that I think sometimes people have a tendency to assume that if they haven't heard of a place, it's kind of like small and maybe underdeveloped. But I think it's definitely a fact of life as well that a lot of major, really developed industrialized cities in China just are not well known outside the country. So, yeah. I think maybe it makes sense to go like a bit like chronologically. And so I wanted to ask whether you can kind of take us back to mid to late January when these reports about the virus were first coming out. Because in the beginning, there were kind of like a lot of rumors, just like flying around. Do you remember what that was like? And especially, what did people know and how, like, did people take it seriously? Like, how did they feel about it?
So, the timeline for me, I think, goes back to December, late December, early January. That's when the rumors of, shutdowns and potential concerns about a SARS-like virus, there wasn't a formal name for it yet, were circulating within WeChat and sometimes Weibo posts. I don't use Weibo regularly, so I'm not authoritative on it, but certainly within my family's WeChat groups, there was a concern that there was some kind of lung disease outbreak. And my family particularly sensitive to this because my grandfather has chronic lung problems. So this is a sort of health issue that we take very, very seriously because he has to be hospitalized in the past. And an infectious disease would not be good for someone of his age and health status. And so the timeline for this, I think, really started in early January. By mid-January, Wuhan was still going on with business as usual, including a couple of really large gatherings that were taking place prior to New Year's. And New Year's, I think, was definitely a turning point for how China saw this, because this is a big deal in China, as you know, because for a lot of Chinese people, this is their one chance per year to see their families. China relies a lot on migrant workers. Those migrant workers travel from the cities where all the jobs are to rural provinces where their family members are. And so shutting down New Year's is a pretty big deal, both for them and for, you know, politicians and leaders, because China's politicians are always trying to impress each other for potential promotions and, you know, nicer party and government job slots. Canceling New Year's events was something that Wuhan's political leadership was very hesitant to do. And now in March, I'm looking at all these politicians saying, I don't want to close beaches or I don't want to close churches. And it's a very frustrating sense of deja vu because it's, you know, that they have, you know, careers and economies at stake, but the costs of keeping things open, given the qualities of this virus, are completely devastating.
How much of it was because information and rumors about this virus had been, or like also messages about this virus had been circulating on social media for a while, way before the Chinese government ever did anything. So was there a sense that like, was there like any sense of like public pressure or like public demands for like the government doing something or like requests for information? Or was that something that was very much like kept down at the time?
I think that at the time, Wuhan's government had been tamping down a lot of information. And as of now, we know that whistleblowers like Dr. Aifen, Dr. Li Wenliang were not able to circulate information within their own medical networks. Not to the general public necessarily, but to their own medical networks as much as they had wanted. And so this, I think, functionally delayed how well hospitals were prepared to take on the influx of patients. The general public, of course, were used to information being intransparent within China. Most Chinese people are well aware that they're not getting the same types of information as, you know, someone without browsing the internet without the Great Firewall. But medical professionals, this, I think, was something that they had not expected to get censored about. And this was something that ultimately caught medical professionals in Wuhan off guard later when the scale of the disease became clearer and clearer.
When did you, do you think the mood changed? Was that something that, like, did people begin realizing the gravity of the situation more broadly when the lockdown actually happened and was imposed from above? Or was it the rising death toll before? Like, what was, like, when did the mood change and how did it happen?
For domestic Chinese, and the general public in China, I would say the mood changed when a very distinguished doctor named Zhong Nanshan made a public announcement after visiting Wuhan that he really, he's analogous to Dr. Fauci here in the States.
I think in Germany, he's probably comparable to Christian Drosten. So for all Germans.
So a very well-known, well-respected infectious disease expert. And he is known in China as doing research and infectious disease work on SARS, which is the last really big concentrated on China infectious disease outbreak. He went public right around the time of Wuhan's lockdown and said, this is a serious, serious disease. It's do not mess with it. It also is transmittable from person to person. And that fact that coronavirus, COVID-19, is transferable from person to person, that is the most fatal factor in Wuhan's mismanagement. The fact that there are two factors to this disease that I think were severely underestimated, that it can spread from person to person and symptoms take a while to show up, and sometimes the disease is asymptomatic. The fact that this wasn't detected ahead of time, and I'm not faulting China necessarily for not figuring out ahead of time, because this is a new disease. This is something that really, really hit Wuhan hard later. And when Zhong Nanshan went on public television and said, you know, this is a serious, serious problem, Wuhan went on lockdown. Those, I think, were the two big changes to the Chinese general public, that they had something really dangerous on their hands.
Yeah, I remember, like, I have a lot of friends, and in many ways, it's also, it feels like a lot of patterns are similar again, where a lot of young people in China were pretty early in catching on to saying that this is like something that's very serious. And it seems like a similar thing is replaying now in like Europe and many, and like North America as well, where it's a lot of young people who are very concerned. And there's kind of like these weird waves. What happened, like, so Wuhan went into lockdown like pretty early, and that kind of like prevented some of that Chinese New Year travel that usually would have gone out of the city, but most of the like a lot of people had already left. Can you give me a sense of how people dealt with that? Like, suddenly their entire city was just shut down. I think the announcement was made with something like 6 hours notice or something. So how did people deal with that lockdown? Which, like, I saw pictures of the streets of Wuhan, like almost of the first day of lockdown, and everything was empty. It was incredibly eerie. And I wonder what that was like for people in the city, to the extent that you know about it.
So the lockdown did happen very fast. And most of my extent of knowing about the lockdown comes from what my family members are still going through. It's still technically under lockdown. And video bloggers and, you know, people posting on social media what Wuhan is like. So a lot of people were, you know, stuck in their houses or, stuck within their little like neighborhood communities. So there's like little courtyard areas or strolling paths within like closed off communities. So people in slightly better health could, you know, take a short walk once a day. But for older people like my grandparents, it wasn't recommended that they go outdoors for long periods of time. In terms of how people in Wuhan dealt with the lockdown, I think they were hit with the announcement really suddenly, and a lot of them had to really adjust on the fly to, you know, how they were going to get food, how they were going to get certain necessities like, you know, drugs and pharmaceuticals. I would say that the latter really, really hit certain households hard because, you know, COVID-19 doesn't put a pause on other health needs. And so people picking up drugs or getting treated for other diseases initially, they were a really, really big risk vector for, you know, the symptoms of the disease. And sometimes you had, you know, people accompanying their loved ones to the hospital and then getting the disease themselves and then, you know, falling sick and in some very unfortunate cases dying from COVID-19. That was, I think, something that they had to adjust to on the fly. So some of these early missteps had to be remedied really quickly by quarantining people outside of their homes so they wouldn't spread the virus to their family members, increasing testing and constructing temporary quarantine and treatment facilities. That was a big part of the response, in addition to the lockdown that was targeted at keeping Wuhan like relatively safe and the numbers like better than they would have been otherwise. So it definitely got hit the hardest out of all of China's provinces, even though, you know, the data is censored and it's not the most transparent numbers. You can't fake the stress that COVID-19 puts on any given health system. That's just not something you can hide. And if China's government has figured out how to hide it, I don't know about yet.
I'm wondering, especially what, because you mentioned that a lot of people who have like other health issues, and there's also a lot of talk about like how older people are at like particular risk. And I think one pattern that we're also seeing now in like Europe and North America is that people are trying to figure out like what to do about their grandparents. Like, should they just tell them to like stay inside all the time? Or like, how careful can you be? And I'm wondering, do you have any sense of how that was dealt with in Wuhan? Like how people protected like their relatives who were the most at risk?
Well, in Wuhan, there were people physically stationed at the gates of communities. On a normal basis, most communities, apartment buildings, you know, they have a person at the door who acts kind of at like a quasi-landlord or sometimes I think it is the landlord, but also, you know, someone there to sort of watch for deliveries and act as a security person. These people often would, during the COVID-19 crisis, not let people out of their communities if they didn't have a valid pass. My aunt, who was a doctor, had a travel pass that allowed her to go to and from work because she had a reason to be out. And so this type of, you know, curfew system that was enforced not only by Chinese law enforcement, but also by, you know, community workers themselves, I think helped enforce the lockdown and prevent people from leaving. A lot of like Western media or analysts will say, oh, you know, it's because Chinese are all obedient Confucians. And I'm like, no, people don't like being cooped up and not celebrating Chinese New Year. This is like they wanted to go out, but you physically had people preventing them from going out. And also all the cops were on the lookout for people that looked like they weren't supposed to be outside. So the enforcement of lockdown, I think, was a mix of, you know, community efforts and law enforcement efforts. And also scare tactics, because the news of, you know, people going to the hospital to pick up drugs with their spouse and then getting sick, that like hits people really hard.
Yeah. How do you even get those passes? Like, you mentioned that your aunt had like a pass because she was like basically an essential worker, I guess. Is that something that you get issued by the local government, or how did that work?
I'm not super clear on the process that those were issued, but because she was a hospital worker, I'm assuming that hospital workers were prioritized. Typically, delivery workers were also allowed on the roads for groceries, for parcels, and for, you know, other essential work duties. I think there were also a couple of journalists active initially. I know Chris Buckley of the New York Times. I think Chow Dung, also of the New York Times. Both are now removed from China at this point, unfortunately. But I think in the early days of the lockdown, you still had a couple of foreign correspondents running around and collecting information. Domestic media was also pretty active. Taiping Magazine, which is economics-focused Chinese media outlet, has been sort of running around at a very impressive level of productivity doing investigative journalism. And I think those people were also active and out and about until lockdowns and travel bans became more and more serious in February.
Yeah, I think honestly, also like as a side note, I think if people want to get a subscription for any Chinese news outlet, like Caixin is definitely one of those outlets that really deserves like any support they can get right now. And they've been doing an incredible job for the past few months, both in English and in Chinese. Since you also mentioned like delivery, so I have like a clarifying question. And then so people were also not allowed to leave their compounds for groceries. Is that correct? Like they had to get stuff delivered, or were you allowed to go to the supermarket?
As time passed, people were not allowed to go to the markets by themselves. And so for communities like my grandparents, there would be organized tuango or group buys by their apartment complex. For some communities, they received deliveries of like aixinzai or like free deliveries of fresh produce. But those did not happen very often. Most of the time, they had to just buy it out of pocket. So because Wuhan is a large city of 11 million people, you know, my sort of educated guess is that the material conditions of residents varied wildly based on, you know, their economic conditions before the outbreak. My grandparents, you know, they have decent pensions, you know, they have some money saved up. They have, both of them had pretty good, solid jobs, particularly my grandfather, who was working as a bureaucrat in Hubei's education bureau before he retired. But not everybody had the same material conditions as them. And so I think because of, you know, the issue of economic inequality, people from lower income households, especially migrant workers in Wuhan, I think really had to struggle through the outbreak.
Yeah, I was going to ask, that was going to be my next question, like, especially for like delivery workers who kind of were exposed to more risk, and like all those people who could not afford to kind of like just stay inside, but actually had to keep working, or who may not necessarily have had the money to just like have everything delivered. Is there any information yet about like how the lockdown impacted those communities?
The gig economy in China often pays by volume instead of a regular wage. I don't know that much about benefits, but I can't imagine those benefits are super great compared to, you know, salaried people who could just, you know, log on from home and work from there. One thing that really impressed me about delivery drivers was that they were able to get protective gear to their workers fairly early on and, you know, disinfect the stuff. A little earlier in this podcast, I got a pizza delivery and we noticed that the person didn't have any gloves on. And so this type of policy is something that, you know, isn't always a given in the gig economy. But the New York Times profiled a delivery driver for Hema, which is a grocery delivery service run by Alibaba. And he actually was able to get masks, gloves, disinfectant spray for his delivery routes fairly early on. I hope that's the case for, you know, all delivery drivers in China. I don't know for sure, but those types of standards for, you know, every type of non-essential worker, I think, is an important factor in spread, the disease spread.
Then I'm curious if you're comfortable speaking about it on a personal level. I'd be really interested how you communicated with your grandparents during this time, and whether you were able to like kind of support them from afar. And I think that's something that a situation that many people find themselves in right now, that they're kind of like in touch with loved ones like remotely, but have like loved ones that are maybe shut in somewhere. And so I'm wondering how that worked out for you or like for your family.
Sure. I'm going to quote Wilfred Chan. He's a New York-based Hong Kong writer. He tweeted a while ago, "Diaspora is mailing masks back and forth across the ocean." And I think that encapsulates what a lot of Chinese Americans, certainly Wuhan, you know, diaspora people went through in the really peak of the outbreak within China, and I think by extension, you know, Hong Kong and so on. I think Taiwan like was able to make its own masks, but I'm sure that people living overseas were able to, you know, try to reach out to their family members and check in. But yeah, like we were checking in to see what types of resources were available. Certainly, securing a way for my grandfather to receive his prescription medicine and any other sort of necessities was something that my family prioritized. But I think what people living overseas were just trying to do is, you know, do you have masks? Do you have disinfectant? Are you able to get enough food? Those were pretty much at the core of what my family was worried about and what we wanted to make sure was not something my grandparents were worried about.
Do you have a sense of how people in Wuhan in particular, but also in the rest of China, were able to cope with the like psychological challenge of being stuck inside for such a long time?
Certainly just occupying their time indoors was something important. It really depended on the economic well-being of specific families. So people who were not as well off in more rural areas of Hubei, the rest of Hubei outside of Wuhan was also sort of under a pretty like serious coronavirus watch. And students in areas where there wasn't as good internet connectivity were really worried about, you know, falling behind in school. Also, as we're seeing in America and probably, you know, Germany as well, you can't do every single job in existence from home. And so, you know, people who were working in, you know, hospitality, in certainly foreign travel, and a lot of other sectors, they had to face a very hard, you know, economic hit. I think that type of pressure certainly, you know, does a lot of psychological damage. And even though China is just sort of coming out of coronavirus, like very cautiously, they're still worried about, you know, additional waves of the virus. I don't think we'll know for certain what type of, you know, psychological damage is being done. Or has been done up to this point.
One thing that I'm also curious about, before we started recording, we talked about a writer, Fang Fang, who wrote a diary during the lockdown from the city. I'm curious, do you think that there was a lot of writing that was coming out of China during this time? Do you think that's something that also helped people to kind of like get through things because people were stuck at home and so there was a lot of processing in writing going on and like a lot of things were being shared?
Yes. A lot of people will write personal blogs using Chinese social media. I'm assuming that some people were also, you know, keeping little paper diaries. I'm actually keeping a paper diary right now of, you know, things going on in the DC area. A lot of things I can't post on Twitter. But basically in China, like, you know, writing down, you know, something, as it is in a lot of places, it's a way for you to sort of process what's going on and sort of let off a little bit of stress. Fang Fang is a pretty well-known novelist in China. I hadn't heard of her before her Wuhan Diaries, but, you know, afterwards, like, you know, I learned that her novels really focused on, you know, people living in Wuhan and Hubei province. And I think one of them was even turned into a movie, but her sort of, you know, diary was one of just, you know, many perspectives, some written, some videotaped, of what life was like during the lockdown. So she pointed out some of the systematic problems of, you know, what really functionally changes life in Wuhan during the lockdown. So, you know, that people can't see their families in the hospital, that, you know, people were dying at a rate that, you know, they had never really seen before in the city. And, you know, the type of trauma, I think, happening in real time was definitely captured in some of that writing.
Yeah, I'll link, I think there's like some English translations online. We'll link to those in the show notes.
Yes, it's also coming out as a book by HarperCollins, I think, later this summer. I'm very excited to see it.
Yeah, I think this is like great for her, and I think it's going to be a really important window for people from abroad into what people in the city went through. I also think one thing that is important is what were people from Wuhan and also Hubei more broadly being treated like in the rest of the country? Like, how was the rest of the country looking at the city or that entire province, which was going through this like incredible tragedy?
It was a mixture of reactions, I would say. Some people were really scared of people from Hubei, even if they weren't in Hubei at the time of the initial coronavirus outbreak. You had villages basically putting up signs and ferreting out people from Hubei as disease vectors. So it's sort of like a smaller scale version of xenophobia that Chinese and other East Asian diaspora are experiencing outside of China. But yeah, there was definitely some stigma against people from Hubei early on. As the disease sort of developed, there was also more sympathetic gestures. I remember seeing a cartoon go viral on Weibo of different food items crowding outside a window, and inside was like a sick bowl of ruogaimian, hot dry noodles, which is a Wuhan specialty. Earlier in March, you know, you saw the window open with the noodles, like, going like, oh, I'm better now, and, like, everybody cheering. So you had some solidarity for Wuhan, but you also definitely had some stigma, and, you know, it just hurts to see that happening to, you know, people from your hometown.
Yeah, I can imagine. We've also mentioned on the site, we already mentioned like social media up top. And so you also work especially on like tech policy. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on how government communication was happening. You already mentioned earlier that a lot of Chinese people know that they're not getting all the information. So where were people getting their information during this time? And how did people feel or react to what the government was telling them? Because there was definitely a lot of like variation in government messaging going on over the past few months.
Right. So when a government official, I think, visited Wuhan in February, I want to say, it's sometime like a little bit later into the outbreak, there was a woman in an apartment complex standing outside her balcony and yelling, it's all fake. Like, it's all fake. 全部都是假的. And I think this sort of example communicates some of the mistrust that developed over official messaging sources over time. So people were really hit hard by the misinformation that it was not communicable from person to person. And Wuhan's health commission and health, the disease center, its reputation was hit very hard because of that, you know, bad communication. So people were, of course, really, really incensed by the confession that Li Wenliang and other doctors had to sign, which basically saying, you know, no, we won't spread false news rumors. When Li died in early February, the outcry on the internet really sort of questioned, you know, like they want doctors to be able to talk about this without fear of disciplinary consequences.
Maybe you can quickly explain what happened with Dr. Li and Dr. I, actually.
Okay.
I'm not sure people necessarily heard of that.
Okay, so Dr. I noticed symptoms in some of the patients she was treating. She's, I think, the head of an emergency medicine department in one of Wuhan's hospitals, and sort of circled some of the issues in, you know, her medical checkups. Dr. Li and some other doctors noticed this. He wasn't even a respiratory, like, specialist. He was an eye doctor, but he spread the information within WeChat groups of his medical school alumni. And, you know, once apprehended, he had to sign a confession by his hospital's disciplinary committee. So saying that he wouldn't spread any rumors. As I said earlier, I think the real impact of this was that it hindered the ability of these specialists to prepare their respective medical facilities. And so, like, what people were really angry at was that because of this delay for what, like, a New Year's feast or, like, New Year's festivities or some politician looking good, they essentially had to risk their lives, and hospitals were overburdened for something, on the grand scheme of things, very trivial. And so this was where a lot of the anger and the mistrust at official information channels were. And the fact that it took Zhong Nanshan, somebody of, you know, his rank, that level of infallibility to really just confirm it that late into the game, I think that was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, he has accountability. On the other hand, nobody who is, like, below that level was able to really be the messenger, the bearer of the bad news without consequence.
What would have been, can you explain that a bit? Like, what would have been the consequence for someone else?
Well, Li certainly was not the same rank as Zhong Nanshan, and he felt the consequences by, you know, being disciplined. And for doctors, it's like, and for just about any other types of workers within China, if you cross the disciplinary committee at your work, or, you know, party cells at your work, you're not going to be in that career, and your prospects are not going to be very good.
Yeah. So given that people didn't really trust the government anymore, I think especially it was a really big moment when Dr. Li then himself died of COVID-19 in early February, right? So given that people were so mistrustful, how did people get information? Like, how did people try to stay informed to make sure that they knew what was going on?
I think that, you know, again, social media, you also did have domestic media that was trying to do more investigative work, including, you know, Cai Xin. I would also say that The Paper, which is another domestic outlet, albeit one that's, you know, more closely aligned with the Chinese Communist Party, they were also doing some investigative work in Wuhan, I think to the point where they actually also got disciplined. Sixth Tone, which is the English sort of sister publication of The Paper, was also doing some, you know, human interests and other types of domestically focused stories, some of which I think got censored and some of which I think were actually tweeted out by David Polk, who's one of their editors, when they weren't able to be published on their site. I think they've definitely come around at this point domestically, because so much of the information control, you know, PR, propaganda efforts have been concentrated on A, rehabilitating Li Wenliang, but co-opting him into, you know, a martyr figure. They held a moment of silence, I think, for him the other day. You know, putting a lot of positive energy, which is a type of, you know, like, it sort of, it is what it says on the tin, but a type of propaganda that really focuses on, you know, feel good stories of, like, you know, heroic nurses and doctors. And by the way, they do deserve every single bit of praise on them because they are, you know, went above and beyond their call of duty. But a lot of these propaganda pieces ultimately put the sort of positive attention on the party, on the government, on Xi Jinping specifically. So I can't really talk about this without mentioning Xi's role in this. In the early days of the crisis, he was kind of hedging, I think, more. He didn't go to Wuhan himself. He sent Li Keqiang, his premier, to Wuhan. He himself, I think, made some speeches about, you know, this is a people's war against the virus. You know, we're going to pull through this from the safety of Beijing, from the safety of, you know, whatever Zhongnanhai office building he was working from. But early on, like, this was something I think he was delegating a lot of tasks out to. And so now in March, you know, as China's nearing the other end of this, Xi made a visit to Wuhan. He's, you know, trying to do a lot of large scale loans and donations of masks and other PPE equipment overseas, sometimes I think selling them in the case of Italy. And this narrative reshaping effort comes at a time when the US, the UK, Australia, so on and so forth, are really struggling with COVID-19. And so this is, I think, presents an opportunity for China to sort of pave over, you know, January and February and try to, you know, use like PPE and mask diplomacy and other types of, you know, PR efforts to try to reshape its image from the first few months of the year.
Yeah, that's definitely something. It's weird to see that time being almost forgotten right now, or like at least in the official narrative, it's something that like seems to disappear.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it in terms of questions from me. Is there anything that you want to add or that you think that maybe we missed that's really important for understanding what happened in the past few months?
I think it's really important to think about the symbiotic effect between provincial local governments and the Chinese central government, because early on, a lot of the blame was shifted to Wuhan's provincial leadership and municipal leadership. Certainly, there was plenty of blame to assign to them, but ultimately, they sort of feed back into a system that rewards them for like paving over, you know, issues that seem minor at the time. And at a certain point in time, COVID-19 was something that, you know, wasn't taken super seriously because they didn't see anything super serious, even though it was just, as it turns out now, the tip of the iceberg. But it's both the missteps of the sort of municipal level government leadership, but also the system maybe wasn't really well designed to handle, you know, that type of security issue that was sort of looming from the outside. And I do think that this is going to be one of the biggest, you know, international security issues of the year, as the US and Germany and other places are finding out very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thanks again so much for making time and coming on. And if people want to follow your work, we'll link to definitely your Twitter, which I would highly recommend. And then if you have any other publications that you want us to link, then we'll also include those in the show notes.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
So, hier nochmal Katharin. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Ich hoffe, euch hat die Folge gefallen. Ich wollte nochmal ein kurzes Update geben, wie es bei uns in den nächsten Wochen weitergeht. Zum einen, wenn euch neben dem Podcast auch regelmäßigere Updates zu aktuellen Ereignissen interessieren, dann gibt es ja auch den Fan-Ostwärts-Newsletter. Regulär erscheint der alle 2 Wochen. Aber weil ich mich gerade im Semesterendspurt befinde und super viel zu tun habe mit der Promotion, wird die nächste Ausgabe am 25. Mai rauskommen. Tatsächlich gab es jetzt aber gerade gestern auch eine neue Ausgabe, in der ihr unter anderem nachlesen könnt, wie gerade die Situation bezüglich Covid-19 in China ist und wie die Hongkonger Regierung die Aufmerksamkeit, die gerade komplett auf das Virus gerichtet ist, ausnutzt, um wirklich massenweise demokratische AktivistInnen festzunehmen. Das ist wie immer natürlich über fernostwärts.substack.com oder ihr könnt den Link in den Shownotes anklicken oder ihr könnt auch bei unserem RSS-Feed subscriben. Darüber hinaus haben wir noch ein paar extra Folgen oder eine extra Folge mindestens eingeplant für euch in den nächsten Wochen und hoffen, dass ihr spätestens in 2 Wochen die nächste Folge in eure Feeds bekommt. Und in der Folge wird es besonders um chinesischen Journalismus gehen, die Rolle von chinesischen JournalistInnen besonders in der Berichterstattung zu Covid-19 gespielt haben, weil sie wirklich sehr stark dazu beigetragen haben, dass wir viele von den Sachen wissen, die wir über das Virus und gerade die frühen Tage des Virus jetzt wissen. Zunächst freut euch auf die Sonderfolge in 2 Wochen am 20. Mai. Danach geht es ganz regulär weiter am 3. Juni. Wie immer freuen wir uns natürlich über jegliche Unterstützung. Wenn ihr Feedback zu der Folge habt, kommentiert bitte, schickt uns eine E-Mail, schreibt uns auf Twitter an. Wir freuen uns immer, wenn ihr uns sagt, was funktioniert hat für euch, was nicht funktioniert hat. Und das ist auch immer toll, wenn wir das an unsere GästInnen weitergeben können, wenn es da positives Feedback gibt. Von daher, genau, schreibt uns. Und wenn ihr uns finanziell unterstützen wollt, dann könnt ihr das immer gerne tun. Ihr könnt es über Steady machen mit einer regelmäßigen Mitgliedschaft. Ihr könnt uns auch irgendwie einfach eine Überweisung schicken, da freuen wir uns auch drüber. Oder ihr könnt uns bei PayPal einmalige Spenden schicken. Das wäre paypal.me/fernostwärts. Aber wie immer, gerade in diesen Zeiten wissen wir, dass es schwierig ist finanziell für alle und im Zweifel hoffen wir vor allem, dass es euch gut geht, dass ihr sicher bleibt, dass ihr gesund bleibt. Wir hören uns in 2 Wochen wieder. Bis dann. Ciao.